Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company from the Archives. Today, novelist and short story writer Anita Desai. From India to England and then to the U.S., her award-winning career spans 50 years. Anita Desai writes with elegance and sensitivity about the collisions of cultures. In novels such as Baumgartner's Bombay and The Journey to Ithaca, she explores what happens when West goes East, what her characters are looking for, and what they find. In Fasting Feasting, an Indian student encounters an alien world in New England. And in her most recent book of novellas, The Artist of Disappearance, it's the past that impinges on the present. Her characters remain in India but are haunted by other lives. In the title story, the artist is in exile from society itself. Anita Desai is a writer of great subtlety, and while she's often regarded as a quiet writer, in fact, as her daughter Kiran Desai, the Booker Prize-winning novelist, has observed, Anita's books often feature great violence, tremendous frustration, and unhappiness, sometimes silenced unhappiness, but no less loud for that. At the same time, her work covers a wide emotional range, perceptive and even witty, but usually suffused with longing. Desai admits to a certain loneliness, inheriting, as she says, a fragmented world. Anita Desai was born in India in a hill station north of Delhi in 1937, the youngest of three girls, with an older brother. Her father was a Bengali businessman who studied in Germany, where he met and married her mother, a German woman, before they moved back to India in the 1920s. Desai was brought up to be very Indian, she says, though she spoke both German and Hindi at home. She learnt English at school and began writing while very young. Later, she studied English literature at the University of Delhi. Anita Desai has written short stories, children's books, and 12 novels, three of which, Clear Light of Day, In Custody, and Fasting Feasting, were shortlisted for the Booker Prize. In Custody was also made into a colorful and poignant movie by Ismail Merchant of Merchant Ivory Productions. In the mid-1980s, Desai began teaching in England, and then, in 1993, in the U.S., for many years at MIT in Boston, while also a fellow of Girton College in Cambridge, England. Now she's retired from teaching and lives in the Hudson Valley, north of New York City. In 2017, Anita Desai was awarded Montreal's Blue Metropolis International Literary Festival Grand Prix for Lifetime Achievement. That's when I had the opportunity to interview her on stage at the Grand Bibliothèque. You often return in your fiction to your birthplace, Missouri, an Indian hill station in the foothills of the Himalayas. Can you describe it, what it was like there during your childhood?
Well, actually, I grew up in Old Delhi. That's where our home was and where I went to school and college. But I've never got over that thrill of the end of the academic year when one was done with the school exams and we would catch the train and go up into the mountains, and the huge contrast between the heat of May and June in a North Indian summer and the dust storms that made life so uncomfortable at that time of year, and then to find oneself in the cool and the wonder of this open space and these mountains and greenery, the contrast between the two has stayed with me.
And it's still a place that you'd like to visit or to go back to?
I do. I was there just a few months ago.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
And life in Old Delhi, what was that like?
Life in Old Delhi, it was in those years extremely quiet. Apart from home, family, school, there was really very little else that I can tell you about. Except that it was working up to this enormous cataclysm, this huge event of the partition of India and Pakistan. And life had been so quiet before that, I couldn't quite understand what was happening all around me, although I felt the effects of all our Muslim neighbors and friends and others in school suddenly disappearing, and the city being instead flooded with refugees from Pakistan. And it gave me my first experience of how the world can change within a brief lifetime.
You were only 10 years old at the time of partition.
Yes.
Do you have any vivid memories of that time?
I do. I remember it being summertime, and of my parents and their friends being extremely tense, of having subdued conversations that they'd end abruptly if they saw us trying to listen. And I remember them putting our shoes beside our bed at night in case we had to get up in the middle of the night and leave. And I also remember the fires burning along the horizon, fires which were burning in the old city at that time. So there was a great sense of drama, certainly, and I became aware of the drama of a political life, the life outside home and the safety, security of home.
Did anyone explain to you what was happening? Did they tell you at school what was taking place?
No, not really. If they did, certainly I couldn't quite take it in. It was such a complete transformation of the scene I knew.
Neither of your parents was from Old Delhi, and they were both exiles, you've said, removed from the lands of their birth. Can you tell me a little about them? First, your father, what was his background?
My father was born and he grew up in Bengal, in what was known then as East Bengal, later became Pakistan, East Pakistan, and is now Bangladesh. So he was exiled several times over. But as a young man, he went to Germany to study. In those days, it was the place to go for one's higher education, especially in science and engineering. This would be in the
20s. 1920s.
Mm-hmm. And he met my mother there, who was a school teacher, and they made this amazing decision to marry and to come to India to live. And my mother knew nothing about India other than having met my father. She knew nothing at all, although she told me she at that time tried to read Tagore and Sarojini Naidu, the great Indian poets, to learn something. But
do you know how they met?
Well, very interestingly, they were introduced by a German sculptor, George Kolbe, who saw my father walking down the street and asked if he would sit for him for a sculpture he wanted to do. He was very interested in Asian features, Asian figures. And he did two statues of my father, a bust and a torso, and became a great friend of my father's. And he knew my mother, this young girl, and introduced them and was best man at their wedding. And years and years later, the first time I went to Berlin, which was the city they lived in, I visited the museum, the George Kolbe Museum, to see his work. And there I came upon these astounding figures of my father as this very young man. Of course, I couldn't recognize him at all. But the strange thing was he looked exactly like my brother. Yes.
Because you've described your father as a reticent man, but did he tell you some stories about growing up in East Bengal? What was that?
Very few stories. He told us a little, especially about the village the family came from before they moved to Dhaka, about growing up in this land of rivers and rice fields, how the land would be flooded for months at a time. They would have to get into a boat and paddle if they wanted to get anywhere, which absolutely enthralled us as children growing up in North India, which is really a desert, the most arid place you can think of. So to us, it sounded so romantic.
He never brought Bengali, his native tongue, into the house. Do you know why?
Well, You see, he took my mother to Bengal first, just really for a visit. I think they both realized they couldn't live there. They could probably live in a bigger city, and they moved to Delhi. At that time, it was still Old Delhi, not New Delhi. And he set up his practice there. He worked there as an engineer. And because of all the politics of the time, of the Indian independence and thereafter, of course, he didn't live to see the birth of Bangladesh, but it was cut off to him, and they stayed in Delhi, never went back. And he never tried to pass on his language to us. So we grew up speaking German as the family language, speaking Hindi to all our neighbors and friends around us, but sadly not Bengali.
And your father's family was quite political. I think it was that his uncle and grandfather were active?
My father's father, yes. My grandfather and my uncle were definitely involved in the freedom movement. My uncle was in prison for many years as a political activist. And I remember him only coming out of prison to spend a few days with us and bringing as a present for my mother a rug that he had woven while in prison, where he was taught to weave. And the picture in the rug was of a ship sailing across the sea and flying a flag with my mother's name on it.
And do you have a sense, or did your parents ever talk to you about what they saw in each other? Do you understand how they got together in Berlin?
In Berlin? Well, for my mother, he was just the most romantic person she could think of. People knew so little about India then. And it was still an exotic land. It was not a land of, you know, the kind of reputation it has now for all its troubles, its poverty, its many other dramas. But at that time, it was simply a land of poetry. And in fact, while my father was a student there in Berlin, the poet Rabindranath Tagore did come to visit, and we had a photograph of him amongst all the other Indian students sitting beside the great poet. For him, it was a very happy time.
And was the marriage accepted by their families?
Strangely enough, yes, very much so. Maybe not initially, but my mother's mother was very fond of this son-in-law of hers, and my father's family accepted my mother. She was almost idolized by his brothers, who were both younger than him, and looked upon her as this elder sister who'd come from far away.
Unlike your father, you say your mother talked about her childhood constantly. What kinds of things did she tell you about?
You know, she would tell us these. She was a wonderful storyteller. She could tell us the familiar Grimm's fairy tales, but as no one else has ever told them to me, never heard them, so wonderfully embroidered and detailed that she would do. And the same way she could tell us about, you know, Christmas in Germany or Easter or skating on frozen lakes and eating strawberries in summer. And it was all like fairy tales to us. It didn't resemble anything in our own world. So we thought of them as all these marvelous fairy stories she spun. But she also played the piano and she sang German Lieder.
And you grew up speaking German at
yes,
home with her?
Yes, yes. And we all sort of enjoyed it as part of a fantasy, not realizing till we were, you know, grown up, out of what deep homesickness and nostalgia this must have come. She never spoke of that to us.
Because she raised you in what was essentially an Indian household.
Absolutely. And of course, the war intervened. It broke out not so long after she had come to India. And during the war, she was completely cut off from Germany. I remember her listening to the radio for reports of what was happening in Europe, never getting a letter. There were no letters at that time during the war. And I remember accompanying her to the post office to send off parcels of tea, coffee, cocoa to send to Germany and never knowing whether they actually arrived over there. And after the war, she realized that her Germany was completely demolished, especially Berlin, of course. And she never wanted to return. And as
she lost family as well?
She lost family too. And as adults, my siblings and I would try and persuade her to just go on a visit, see the few surviving friends, distant relations. And she would become quite tearful and beg us not to make her go. She just did not want to see that Germany at all.
Was it hard for her? I mean, in terms of being in India during the war?
It must have been hard because it was British India at that time. And other German friends of hers, the few German friends she had in India, they were actually taken to an internment camp. My mother wasn't, because she'd become an Indian citizen.
By marrying your
father? On marrying my father. But those who hadn't spent the war years in internment camps in India, that few people seem to know about in the outer world. And that's why I later wrote a book called Baumgartner's Bombay, trying to evoke that time, what the world had gone through in those days.
You visited Germany yourself. You say you went back.
I did.
What did you find there?
Well, I visited Berlin, of course, and at that time there was still a wall across the city, so it didn't resemble at all what my mother had evoked in her stories. Besides, so much of it had been flattened during the war, during the bombardment, and what had come up was a mostly modern city. And it was very painful for me to go back and tell her, actually, I couldn't find any of the things she had told me to go and look for.
As a child growing up in those times, how did you absorb the stories of your parents' vanished past? I mean, you say you were brought up to be totally Indian, but there were these other histories, these other cultural influences.
I think neither of my parents made any attempt really to affect the lives that we were leading, that we had been born to. I was very impressed when my mother once told me that when she left for India, her mother told her, don't bring up your children thinking that they are a part of them exists in Germany. Bring them up as if they were Indians. Hmm. And she did. And I have to be very grateful for her giving us this very solid, secure sense of identity.
Although you once talked about seeing India through your mother's German eyes and your father's Bengali heart. What did that mean?
Well, I realized that I had the same emotions about India as my father did. And I was also aware of my mother having a very different mindset, a very much more rational mind, I would say, and of her being very careful to articulate her criticisms, which she had. She certainly did have them, but being very careful not to impose them on us. But I was aware that she thought differently from my father and from her children. And I have enormous respect for her, having remained herself too, having kept her own mind to herself.
Anita Desai, coming of age and becoming a writer in the newly post-colonial era, you've described yourself as the inheritor of a fragmented world. The past is always very present in your work. Do you understand why that is?
Maybe it's because of the history I've just been talking to you about, and also a sense of a new world being constructed all around me. I mean, India had just gained independence. The British had left. They had had such an enormous effect, for instance, upon the school I went to, where I studied English and English literature. And now they were all gone, and we were constructing this new world. So I was very aware of what belonged to the past and what was being created now in the present.
Because your work has focused on ordinary lives, but often at some level there's a kind of heroism amidst the tragedy and despair of your characters. Can you talk about that?
Well, it has to do with an awareness that, which I think many Indians share with me, especially those who are still living in India, not here abroad, that a certain life is given to you. And it's only a very rare person who can alter that, who can make something different for themselves than what they've inherited, what is expected of them. Partly it is to do with a very traditional society, a basically conservative society, but partly it has to do with history itself. I think it's Bolaño has a line about the individual having an uneven battle with history. In the end, it's history that wins, that makes you what you are. So there's a certain heroism in trying to make something of your life when everything goes actually against it.
Is it something that you've experienced yourself? Is something that you identify with personally?
Yes, I would, because, as a woman, a certain life is expected. You're expected to lead a certain kind of life. To do anything other than that is something which is not looked upon as quite normal. And one has to find a way to justify it, to justify what you are doing. So yes, that is a struggle. For instance, it wouldn't be expected of me to have a career in the sense it wasn't needed. You know, you didn't have to earn a living, you didn't have to have a career, and this is something which I fought against, absolutely necessary to me.
Because you had 4 children.
Yes,
and so
absolutely.
You would be expected to raise them and...
Yes, it should have been quite enough to make me content, to live contentedly. But why should I want something more? But there was always that need, a compulsion to have something more, and that something more was a literary element, a writer's world, to live by my writing. And then, of course, to leave India to make a living abroad, that also is not expected of one. Again, one has to justify one's reasons for doing so.
Because you ventured beyond the domestic realm, especially in novels such as Journey to Ithaca or Baumgartner's Bombay, and those books did coincide with your leaving, your own move away from India. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the effect of that, of leaving the country?
Well, that again was a kind of revolt against being expected to write only about the domestic life of a woman, which I did in my earlier book several times. And then I myself found this world claustrophobic. While writing it, it seemed to be claustrophobic. And I wanted to open a door and step out into the world which lay right outside and step into it and see what was happening there and write about that. And I realized I'd have to make a very conscious effort to stop writing about the lives of women only, exclusively, but to also write about a world in which men lived, in which men had lives and histories very different. And I remember the first book that I did that with was In Custody, which I conceived of as a book about an entirely male world, which the world of Urdu poetry at that time was.
This is Urdu poetry in India?
In India, yes. Very few women wrote it. There were some, but all the major poets were men, and were surrounded by men who particularly approved and loved and enjoyed that form of poetry. And it wasn't my world at all. And I had to step into that mentally and emotionally. And the first draft I wrote of that book had only male characters, because that was what I was trying so hard to do. And I set it for myself as a challenge. And then I kept hearing this banging and screaming in the background.
Because the story is about a school teacher who goes, who's an acolyte of this old Urdu poet, and he wants to capture his words before he dies, and he brings this old tape recorder and he wants to record him. It was also made into a film by Merchant Ivory, and I think you co-wrote the screenplay for that. So that, just for the context, that's the male world of, of this. And there's screaming in the background.
Yes, and I wondered, well, who are these people screaming in the background? And I realized, well, it's the women, isn't it, who want to be let in and asking, why are they being excluded? Why can't they share in this world? So I had to allow them to step onto that stage I had set. And they behaved very badly. They had fights, they screamed, they were really extremely difficult women. And I had to explain why they were that. And
I know. Then you were criticized for having, first you were criticized for having this domestic world featuring only women or focusing on women, and then you were criticized for when having this male world and in custody, but depicting the women as being such.
Exactly, they weren't nice people at all. And I thought, well, if you've been so oppressed and excluded always, then surely you will burst out. You will bang the doors. You'll slam the doors. Your voice will rise to a scream. Inevitably, it'll happen. So I had to let them play their part on the stage.
Your novel, Baumgartner's Bombay, which came out in 1988, focuses, as you were saying, it invokes the world of your mother, although you make key differences. First of all, it's focused on a man, and he's a German-Jewish refugee, escapes to India in the 1930s. He's interned there as an enemy alien for the length of the war, and then never leaves. Where did this character come from, I mean, Baumgartner? What interested you in his history?
Well, I think that was another challenge that I had set myself. I had grown up with these two languages, well, three languages, German, English, and Hindi. But the German language I had to keep more or less suppressed, certainly when I was writing. I was writing in English, and I was bringing in Hindi speakers. But the German language had to be suppressed. And I felt an urge to bring that into my writing as well. So I was really looking for a subject, somebody who would allow me to do that, a character who would allow me to do that. And I certainly didn't want to write a story about my mother, nothing biographical at all. And
why not? I mean, why? You say you certainly didn't want to write about, why?
Well, that is far too personal. I don't think I could ever do that, not even now. And then a few strange things happened. I was living in Bombay at the time, and I noticed this European man, elderly European man, out on the streets, who would carry paper bags with him and take out food for the stray cats in the street and feed them. And I thought it was a very strange thing. And Europeans in India were mostly well-to-do and lived comfortable lives. I never met him or talked to him. Didn't know anything about him. But a friend of mine at about this time in Bombay brought me a packet of letters. They were written in German. He said a German he knew had just died and he was without a family. There were no heirs. So my friend had been asked to clear up his affairs for him. And he'd found this packet of letters and brought them to me and said, can you read them and see if they're of any importance? So I read them, and they were of no importance whatsoever that I could see. They were obviously family letters, and they merely said repeatedly, how are you? Are you well? I am well. Don't worry, I am well. I hope you are well. And that was all. So I handed them back to my friend, and I said, I don't think they're important at all. But at this time, I was reading a good deal about the Second World War and the Holocaust. And I learned that in the early years, at least, of the concentration camps, the inmates of the camps were allowed to send out a certain number of letters. They were rationed, maybe one or two a month. And that they would each be stamped with the number that the inmate was tattooed with. And I just remembered then that each letter that I had read had a number stamped on it. So, of course, I couldn't go back and ask anyone what had happened to this particular man or what his history was. I had to imagine it for him. So all these things came together, the German language from my family, seeing this man feeding cats in the streets of Bombay, then the history that came into my hands, and I let them go. So the novel was really a putting together of all these fragments.
Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Anita Desai, I'd like to talk a bit about your novel, Fasting, Feasting, which returns to the domestic realm, but with the wider perspective that came with your move to the United States in 1993. It focuses on family in a provincial Indian city, and as the title suggests, food is an important element of the story, as it is so often in family life. Why is that?
Well, I had to choose some kind of matter that would bring these two worlds together, sitting down at a table, being fed by your mother, or eating at a table, is a universal symbol, really, of family life. So I thought that was a simple, easy one to use. But what surprised me with that book, you know, so many of one's own books surprise one. You look back and you think, what on earth made me write this? What is it all about? And the strange thing was I had just moved to the United States. I was teaching at a small college in New England and finding myself a complete stranger over there. And I thought I'd lost my Indian world. I'd lost the material from which all my books came, and I would never be able to write another word. So I sat down and made myself write, and then I found what I was writing about was the world I knew best, which was the Indian family world, really. And it had followed me. It hadn't deserted me. I had simply brought it along with me. But I had to let in this new world that I was in too, which I could look at when I walked down the streets. I looked in at people's windows, their yards, and that had to be brought in as well. So I put together these two very disparate halves, and what would hold them together? I needed something simple and universal that would hold them together.
And that was food, fasting.
But
and
it wasn't a matter of one country going without and the other gorging
no,
on
in
too
fact,
much.
Everybody hungers for something
yes.
in both America and
yes.
in India.
Yes,
in
it
the
was
world
really
of
also
novel.
Finding similarities of a kind in these two very, very different worlds.
The first part of the novel, Fasting, Feasting, introduces us to this formidable parental unit, Mama, Papa, and these the names are combined in the minds of their children because they're so sufficient in themselves. They're always agreeing on parental matters, and it's this unit of Mama, Papa. Could you read a short passage from the novel?
Uma, pass your father the fruit. Uma picks up the fruit bowl with both hands and puts it down with a thump before her father. Bananas, oranges, apples, there they are, for him. Blinking, he ignores them. Folding his hands on the table, he gazes over them with the sphinx-like expression of the blind. Mama knows what is wrong. She taps Uma on the elbow. Orange, she instructs her. Uma can no longer pretend to be ignorant of Papa's needs, Papa's ways. After all, she has been serving them for some 20 years. She picks out the largest orange in the bowl and hands it to Mama, who peels it in strips, then divides it into separate segments. Each segment is then peeled and freed of pips and threads till only the perfect globules of juice are left, and then passed one by one to the edge of Papa's plate. One by one, he lifts them with the tips of his fingers and places them in his mouth. Everyone waits while he repeats the gesture over and over. Mama's lips are pursed with the care she gives her actions and their importance. When she has done, and only Pith and Peel and Pips lie on her plate, and nothing at all on Papa's, except for the merest smear of juice, she glances over at Uma. Her dark eyes flash with the brightness of her achievement and pride. "Where is Papa's finger bowl?" she asks loudly. The finger bowl is placed before Papa. He dips his fingertips in and wipes them on the napkin. He's the only one in the family who's given a napkin and a finger bowl. They are emblems of his status. Mama sits back. The ceremony is over. She has performed it. Everyone is satisfied. Thank you.
Anita Desai, reading from her novel, Fasting, Feasting. Uma, the eldest child of the family and the central character of the first part of the book, she's not a great student, she's not a great beauty, she's a girl and later a woman of very few prospects. Mama, Papa, the parents, treat her almost as a servant and don't seem to recognize her. Why is that? I mean, is it just the status quo in Indian families? Or?
Well, people have asked me about the dedication of that book. I dedicate it to those whose stories I've told. And actually, I knew an Uma. She did tell me a few times. I knew of her frustration at not being able to live the life she would have liked to live, if not as a wife and mother, which she failed to do, but then perhaps as a working woman. She was so frustrated, and she spent the rest of her life really looking after Mama, Papa. And she told me once, "You must tell my story." So I gave myself permission to do so.
And there really was a Mama, Papa, more or less, as you described?
Yes, there were.
Where Mama defers to Papa all the time. And
Somebody asked at the festival just yesterday, why is it that women in the family sometimes can be so harsh, especially harsh to their daughters, more so than their sons, whom they tend to spoil? And I had to think a bit about it before I answered, and I thought it must be because women take on this role of keeping the family intact, of keeping society and its traditions intact in a way. And they don't necessarily do so, certainly don't today. But certainly that was the role of women through Indian history. You keep society as it is, stable, secure, intact. And they saw to it that this role was passed on to the daughter rather than the son.
Although you give Uma, or perhaps the real Uma, had already a certain spiritual element in her life.
Well, it's hard to describe what a strong role that plays in Indian life, the spiritual life. And it's hard to say if the reason is because reality is often so difficult, so harsh, so painful, so tragic, that one needs an escape. And the easiest escape is a mental one. It's easier than a physical escape. But at least mentally, emotionally, one can escape into another realm of life.
And so you gave Uma that?
I gave Uma that, which she had seen her aunt pursue, a widowed aunt, and thought maybe that was for her. It proved not to be for her either.
Anita Desai, the second part of your novel, Fasting, Feasting, picks up the story of Arun, Uma's younger brother, the bearer of all the parental dreams and hopes, and he's spending his first summer in the United States and after college staying with an American family. And this portrait of the Americans, it's quite satirical. I think you must have had some fun with that, but it's also very sad. Can you talk about these Americans, their eating habits, what you wanted to say about American life?
You know, that's how the novel turned out, that he happens to be in a family, staying with a family over the summer, in which the mother happens to be frustrated in very much the way Uma is. She also lives a very circumscribed life. And mentally, she hasn't even the ability to remove herself from it into another world, not even mentally, let alone physically. And she manages to nourish her own self with not particularly eating all the time, but by providing these enormous meals. Food seems to her to be some kind of outlet. It's her achievement, like mama peeling an orange, being the keeper of that one orange on the table. She also feels the keeper of the kitchen, of her ability to feed her family is what gives her her status.
But it's almost the case of each family dinner table is dysfunctional in its own way, to do a variant of unhappy families.
Well, family dramas often take place over the dinner table, don't they?
Arun himself is painfully isolated, and he's determined to stay that way. Why is he so closed off?
I think he's one of the people of whom so much is expected. So much has been put into his education, into sending him abroad. And he's weighed down by these expectations, these huge hopes, high hopes that have been pinned on him. He never quite escapes from them. And he has a great feeling of inferiority, therefore, not being able to live up to them. And I think the Indian men who come abroad either for their education or to get jobs and work cannot possibly free themselves ever from their families, their homes, the society from which they've come, and know that they need to play a role in it, and not everyone is up to it. Very few are, in fact. So there's always a great sense, I think, of failure, a fear of failure, really, which is what Arun suffers from.
So in a way, you've answered my next question, which was about how there's so much misery in this novel, so the women are oppressed with few opportunities. The young man who does have opportunity is oppressed by the expectations that are laid on him. There's also anger, I think, that seems to percolate through these characters. Uma and also in the American family where Arun is staying.
Yes, since none of them are really able to arrive at any real satisfaction in life, there would be a sense of failure. And it would either be kept silent and suppressed, or it would break out in anger, I think.
Anita Desai, you've said it's hard for you to write about the United States and that you still can't quite enter the American world. Is that still the case, given that you've been there since 1993?
Sadly, it's still the case, yes. I think the most I've been able to write about it is a little short story here and there. But I've never taken on a whole novel. For one thing, I don't think I've really entered into that society in the way I have naturally, normally entered into Indian life. I've never made that kind of entry. It remains more or less distant and close to me. And besides, there are all these brilliant American writers who write of this world of theirs. What could I possibly say that would live up to what they've done? It's intimidating for an outsider.
And you still feel an outsider even after, almost 24 years?
Yes, I do really, yes. You know, there's this saying, I believe it's an Arab saying, which divides humanity into three groups. One group which finds his own homeland sweet, his native land is sweet. The other group, which can travel all over the world and makes every land his own land, his native land, which is admirable. And then the third group of people who find every land is a foreign land all over the world.
Even though I think it was three of your children live in the States?
Yes.
And that hasn't made it seem more...
Well, that's the only reason that I've stayed, really. Yes.
The past is also a central theme of your most recent book, a collection of three novellas called The Artist of Disappearance. And these are haunting stories about characters who are in some way themselves haunted. The overall mood is quite melancholic. Why is that?
Why did I choose to put these three melancholy characters together? Well, they're stories that had lived inside me, with me, for a very long time before I actually put them on paper. And perhaps that melancholy thread is what held them together and made me put them together in one volume.
In one of the stories, The Museum of Final Journeys, the narrator recalls his time in a remote outpost as a junior civil servant, and it's dreary and uneventful and until he receives a visit from an old man with a strange tale to tell. Can you talk about the inspiration for this story?
Ah, yes, I'll tell you. It's one of those oddities of the traveling life. I went to the Museum of Oriental Art when I was in Venice. And it was a collection put together by a Venetian nobleman who'd had a great deal of money, traveled, and sent back or brought back these cases and cases of objects that he had collected on his journeys in the Orient. And I remember leaving that museum, walking down those marble stairs and thinking, this is a story I've got to write.
Were you critical or admiring? Or, I mean, what did you make of this collecting impulse of this man?
It's not an impulse I have myself. And I see it, of course, as an obsession, which it is. And every collector has to have his own particular obsession. And then I found myself transferring it to an Indian who travels in the West and sends all these cases back to this mansion that he once lived in and is now abandoned. Yes, and then I wanted to end it with some symbol of travel and how all travels come to an end out of fatigue, out of tiredness, come to dust in the end. So I used this figure of this enormous elephant to stand as a symbol for that.
For how futile it is to collect, or?
It's the inevitable end of one's journey. And then all you are left with are these few little bits and pieces that you have brought with you. And this happened not to be such a small bit and piece, it happened to be an enormous one.
Because in the story, after going through room after room of this collection in various states of, in some cases, the beauty still seems to be there, but in other cases of just disintegration, until the final room after the room after room is a giant elephant. And it's not just the elephant in the room, it's... What does the elephant represent? And apart from the fact that the reader wants someone to take care of it, I mean, it's eating its way through the remains of the estate.
Well, as I say, it's a symbol, really. It happens to be a very large one because it becomes like a dream or like a nightmare, if you will, that continues to haunt the traveler.
Because like a lot of your characters, the narrator who's the civil servant who hears this story and who visits this collection, he has his failings. He seems very passive. And do you understand his inadequacy? Or do you forgive it?
No, I don't forgive him. But I think it's a very human weakness which we all suffer from if we are faced with a problem which we simply can't solve. He should have been able to solve it. He was in a position to solve it. He could have at least taken the poor creature to a zoo, couldn't he? But he doesn't.
He just leaves.
He's so terrified of being faced with this beast that he simply flees and turns his back on it. It's simply a human failing, I think.
And it haunts him as it does the readers, yeah. The title story in that collection, The Artist of Disappearance, is set in the hill station of Missouri that was so important to your past. The central character, Ravi, is a recluse living in the ruins of a burnt-out house, which seems to give it a slightly gothic flavor. Did you intend that?
Well, in my childhood, there was a haunted house in Missouri,
right?
Yes. Well, not really haunted, but yes, there was a house that had been burnt down to the ground so that the local people would all have stories to tell about who'd lived there, what had happened. So as children, one's imagination is set on fire by this.
Because the story, again, features a set of self-involved, self-sufficient parents and a child, an adopted son who's marginalized. And this son becomes increasingly closed off to the human life around him. But he finds solace and he finds himself in nature. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, that's the environment he's grown up in. And having been excluded from every other, it is his natural world. He really belongs to it to an extent that nobody else can understand, because other people have much fuller lives, more interesting, exciting lives. They can't understand that there could be a person to whom one leaf, one stone, one insect could mean so much. So to me, he is a very remarkable, unusual person, and his world is unusual. And at the same time, I wanted to present it as being totally natural. Why would he not be at home in this world? Why would he not find his happiness there?
Could you read a passage from the book? This is where Ravi, who's been living with his extended family in Bombay, but at last, after his parents have died, he returns to his home.
Perhaps he babbled and laughed like a madman on the journey back. Perhaps not. But he remembered leaping onto the platform before the train had quite come to a halt at the station in Dehradun, nearly falling onto his knees, then fighting his way onto a bus to Missouri. His relatives in Bombay would not have believed his ferocity. For a while he continued, desperate. It did not look as if the bus could free itself of the city traffic, and then the country traffic, the other buses and huge lumbering trucks loaded with rocks, logs, sacks and bundles, and men perched on top, their mouths and noses wrapped in scarves against the dust and fumes of exhaust. Where was the silence that he remembered, or the solitude, he asked himself, in a frenzy of impatience, till he realized that each turn in the twisting road was carrying him higher and higher, and the air that blew in through the open windows was cooler, fresher, drier air he could draw into his lungs in long draughts, because it blew, he believed, from the snows themselves, half imagined, half perceived, a pale scribble against a pale sky. Here the forest began. Here a monkey clan sat on a strip of wall, grooming each other and watching the passing buses for a handful of peanuts or a banana tossed out by the laughing passengers. Here a rivulet tumbled over rocks and a rough shelter built of stones and sticks straddled it. Here a pine tree leaned precariously over a cliff, its trunk split in two by lightning. Here an orange grove grew in a green clearing, its fruit glowing bright. The dust and odor of the city and plains left behind. The bus rose higher into the mountains, where these were replaced by the sharp sweetness of pine woods, the smoke of wood fires, the glass-like clarity of mountain air. He covered the last stretch on foot, rediscovering the paths that led out of the town, downhill into the forest, and through it to where the house stood, its roof showing above the treetops. Birds sent out their long fluting calls in spirals that he returned to them in long fluting whistles through the silence.
Anita Desai reading from her novella. A the artist of disappearance. Ravi makes art in the forest. It's a kind of land art or nature art, hidden away. Do you understand that impulse? I mean, he says that no one can see it.
No one can see it. And when somebody steps into that garden, for him it is spoiled. It's
exactly. Do you understand that impulse to make art that is so mysterious and so separate from...
Yes, I do know artists who hold on to their art, who are extremely reluctant to reveal it to the outer world. It means something to them. They understand it, but they don't believe the outside world possibly could. They don't want to lay it open to their, not only criticism, but even their commentaries. It doesn't matter to him. He's made it just for his own delight, his own pleasure. And when it's taken away from him, he finds a way of slipping it into the smallest object that he can carry with him, which is a matchbox in his pocket.
And as a writer who writes for the world, I mean, your work is published in many languages and is read all over the world. Do you relate to that impulse of withdrawal?
Well, I think I have sort of an impulse of self-protection, self-preservation there. Once I've written the book, once I've handed it over to the publisher, once it's in print, I really don't see it as mine anymore. If I see it in a bookshop or in someone's hands, it seems rather a strange object to me. It's no longer mine. It belongs to the readers. Eventually, the book has to belong to its readers. It ceases to belong to me.
Because there's an element also with Ravi that something like Arun in fasting, feasting, and that you've even described yourself to some degree as a child, of just that withdrawal from the world, the separateness, a desire for solitude.
Perhaps it's something that I know as a writer, and not only a desire but a need for solitude. And I think that's what I tried to write about in this passage that I just read aloud, how the mountains seem to provide that. You escape from the world down below, and you are able to rise to a level above that by yourself, and you breathe a different air, which is somehow purer and clearer, and the air is clearer. You see better. Everything becomes transparent for you. And I think that's a desire felt by many people, and especially, I should think, for an artist.
It's great to have the chance to see you again, and congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you, Angela.
Blue Metropolis Grand Prix winner Anita Desai on stage at the Grande Bibliothèque in Montreal in 2017. Her collection of novellas, The Artist of Disappearance, and her novel Fasting Feasting are published by Harper Perennial. Coming up from Picador Press is a new work of fiction called Rosarita. Set in Mexico in the present and India in the past, it's described as a beautiful, haunting novel about mothers and marriage that explores memory, grief, and things unspoken. Today's show was produced by senior producer Sandra Rabinovich, with thanks to Katie Swales and Olivia Pascarelli. You can also hear Writers & Company on our website. Just go to cbc.ca/writersandcompany. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week, to celebrate Poetry Month, one of England's greatest living poets, Alice Oswald, the first woman to serve as Oxford Professor of Poetry, a chair established in 1708. She also won an International Griffin Poetry Prize for her seventh collection, Falling Awake. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.